I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, the show for curious cooks and eaters. So there's a sushi chef named Daisuke Nakazawa who has restaurants in New York and DC. And he hasn't been in the US for long, but he's already one of the most decorated chefs in the country with 2 Michelin stars. But America's first introduction to him was in a movie called Jiro Dreams of Sushi, where after years, and I mean like over a decade, of training with his master, his job was still to sit in the hallway outside the restaurant toasting the seaweed over a little burner before service. And he was like, maybe one day I'll get to touch the fish. So much of Japanese cuisine is about obsessive perfection and craft. You know, the dedication to the tiniest details and the simplest food can consume Japanese chefs for decades. And for food nerds, it can seem like all of Japanese food is this way, from sushi masters on down to street-side grill cooks who think about, you know, the seasonality of their soybeans and their soy sauce. Only, it's not. Japanese food, yes, is exquisite, it's seasonal, one of the great arts of humanity, and it's also instant sauces out of a box, microwaves, and convenient store pantries. And this week, we want to take a look at how regular people in Japan really eat at home most of the time, the way they cook and feed their kids, and we learn about the fascinating history of some of Japan's favorite comfort foods, like curry and omelets. And to start, we're talking with Tomoko Imade Dayan. She calls herself a Japanese food ambassador, and she is the culinary curator of Japan House, a Japanese cultural center in Los Angeles. Hey, Tomoko. Great to have you in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, so when most non-Japanese people, I guess, think of Japanese food, I think we think of things like sushi and tempura and ramen, but that's not really what most people eat at home, right?
No, not at all. I mean, like, we eat tempura once in a while, sushi, maybe we go out once in a while, but most of people at home, we eat variety of things. I think sushi and tempura is just like 1 to 5% of what we eat in general in Japan. We eat sort of like more prepared meal. We cook something in advance, so sort of meal prep. We just do like a little bit of vegetable steamed here, vegetable salad, da, 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 da. And then we eat a little bit of lots of things. So we rarely have like one rice bowl with like one dish. We have probably have like one rice soup and then 5 different small things. That's how we eat in general in Japan.
Yeah. So that's like the meal structure. And you mentioned, you know, if we have sushi, typically you would go out for it. I know the restaurant culture in Japan is often focused on people who specialize in a certain thing. So you would go to, if you want to eat tempura, you would go to a tempura restaurant, for instance.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
Is there a difference between like restaurant food culture and like home cooking food culture?
For instance, like sushi, it's more like celebration dish. When your kid has like a really good grade and then parents ask you like, what do you want to eat today? They will be most likely say, yes, I want to go sushi. So people go sushi. I mean, there's a variety of ranges of pricing. There's like a very expensive one to like really easy going, like you can go to belt conveyor belt. Still, it's a treat. So those are treat meal. And then also sometimes you just want to eat a bowl of ramen noodles or tonkatsu, which is pork cutlet. It's a little bit heavy food, but it's hard to make everything at home, especially like ramen. It's like a stock and a noodle. So people usually go out to eat those things.
Yeah. And what did you grow up eating at home mostly?
I actually lived with my grandparents and my parents, so we had lots of traditional, lots of fish. Most every night, we had simmered fish or grilled fish with tons of vegetable. My grandparents actually never cooked But my mother was, my mom is a really good cook. So she prepared for the whole six of us when I was growing up.
It's interesting to hear your grandparents never cook. How did your mom learn to cook?
I think it's that generation. She's about 70 right now. All she needed after her college was to be good housewife. Mm. So she went to school to learn cooking. And then she, there are lots of books. There are so many books in Japan about cooking. So I think she learned most of it there.
And did you learn to cook through school also, or was it passed down by your parents?
Actually, I just looked at how she does in the kitchen, and then she never really allowed me to be in the kitchen. She wanted me to study, of course. It's Japanese household. Study is the most important thing. So that, and then also I just liked eating since I was growing up. So I just go through magazines, and then I read books, and then I wanted to go to cooking school, but my parents were like, no, you just need to go study and go college and then get degrees. So
that's so interesting, because I feel like when you think of the traditions of home cooking, you know, there is this imagination, there's this vision that appears of, oh, grandparents teach the parents who teach the children, there's this ongoing lineage. And here in the U.S., we think of, oh, that story was kind of disrupted by the 50s, right? When all of a sudden we, you know, started really having a lot of convenience foods and packaged foods in the post-war boom. Mm. But it's interesting to hear in your family, it was not that way either. There were some generations cooked, some generations didn't. You learned through school, you didn't learn at all. If you look around today at your friends and family in Japan, and you think, and you're thinking about how people are learning to cook, how is that happening?
I think it's both. There are still remaining like traditional way, grandparents, mother or father sometimes pass on to the knowledge. But at the same time, there are so many single people right now. Many younger people are not even dating. They just feel lazy, or it's just kind of inconvenience for them to date. So at home, they just buy convenience store food. And then, as you may know, convenience store food in Japan is fantastic.
It's really good. It's like incredibly good.
I know, it's better than some of the restaurants.
You brought up a really interesting thing, which is something I've read about. You know, you mentioned some people are, you know, not dating as much or getting married much later or not married at all. And I read about this in Japan to the point where it seems like people are wondering if this is really going to change Japanese society, if they're just going to be, you know, far fewer families, people getting married and having children. I know you mentioned a lot of people are, you know, they're eating delicious convenience store food. But when it does come to cooking, or it does come to bringing people together to have, if not a literal family, then a family of friends, do you see that affecting the way people are doing home cooking?
It is a little bit. I think especially now, like a younger generation, people still grew up with family meal and then eat with parents. So they kind of miss that atmosphere. Mm. So people gather around with like friends, and then they bring in stuff. Not necessarily they cook, because it will take a long time. most people have jobs. And so there are many delivery systems, including like Uber Eats in Japan. And then also pizza delivery is very popular. So they just get those things and then go to convenience store and get beer. And then they just do like sort of home party. We call home pa. And then they just do that, like as like a pseudo family feel, rather than cooking at home, they do that. Or like sometimes they do like a temaki party, temaki sushi. It's that hand roll. They do that at home. So something like that. That's the extent of like family meal, I think, for the younger generations.
Yeah, that's simple, communal, like a hand roll sushi. Mm-hmm. You can just lay out the nori seaweed. You can lay out the rice and people just sort of make it themselves and they can just sort of hang out. Okay, so there's this term, washoku, right? Mm-hmm. Which means like the more traditional food of Japan. Mm-hmm. But you said to me earlier that when people are cooking at home, they are just as more, maybe more likely to make more Western-style dishes or dishes that were influenced by other cultures at home. Do you know why that is?
I think it's just kids love those food. So when you ask kids what's your favorite food, yes, sushi is there. But other than that, it's hamburger steak or like a cutlet, like Japanese pork cutlet or like a curry rice. It's really huge in Japan. So all those things are derived from outside of Japan, mostly like Western culture. And then those are relatively easy. It's a one meal dish. It's a one dish meal. So it's great for parents as well. You don't have to gather like five different dishes to make meal complete. It's just rice and some sauce, or like hamburger with like side of rice or bread sometimes. So it's pretty easy. And then also delicious. It's Japanese Western food. It's called yoshoku. Mm-hmm. It literally means Western food. And then those are very delicious. It's not very popular yet in the United States. I know there's a few really good yoshoku restaurants in New York City. But I think people will like it, those things. And then those are like really easy. You have lots of packaged like products at home at the grocery store, and you can just buy like a sauce, and then you can just add a vegetable and meat, and then like dinner in like an hour or so.
Yeah. I have to admit that when I go to a grocery store, I normally don't go to the convenience aisles usually. I just prefer to cook stuff from scratch for myself. But when I do go to a Japanese market, it's sort of the first place I go to see all the boxes of sauces because they are so delicious. They're super tasty. I don't feel super great about all the ingredients and all that, but I mean, I get it. And, you know, real people have real lives. If you can open up that box and it's tasty, people are going to do it.
Me too. Yeah, it's some of the ingredients are, yes, very alarming, but it's delicious. It's convenient. So it's getting better, though. Some of the companies try to make it healthier and then less artificial ingredients or like less preservative and stuff like that. So it's getting better.
Okay, so I won't tell you about the box of cream stew mix I have in my pantry right now. This is so interesting, Tomoko. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tomoko Imade-Dayan is the culinary curator of Japan House in Los Angeles. Coming up...
Give me chopsticks.
Okay. It was just the closest thing to me. I'm sorry.
Splendid Table listeners should know that Francis Lim does not have chopsticks.
They're right here. They're right here. Mom, Dad, you hear me? Chopsticks are in my drawer. Right here.
That is Chris Ying, who along with Ivan Orkin came to my home to humiliate me and to show me how to make some quick comfort food, yaki udon. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. So now, we get to a Japanese home cook who's, well, not really Japanese, and arguably not really a home cook, but he's worked harder than anyone at being both those things. Ivan Orkin is the chef of the super popular restaurant Ivan Ramen in New York City. But for many years, that restaurant was actually in Tokyo, where he lived, as really as much as he could, a Japanese lifestyle. And in those years, he cooked for his family, you know, not in the way he did in the restaurant, but really as a home cook would in Japan. He has a new book called The Gaijin Cookbook, and it's all about, you know, the everyday, unfussy home food he learned to make from his Japanese friends and family. He wrote it with his friend Chris Ying, and they made a visit to my house to show me their super quick yaki udon. So Ivan, Chris, thank you so much for coming to my house.
Thank you.
My God, I can't believe we got invited in finally. We just sat outside the door begging for weeks to get in here.
The lines were long. Tickets were available online.
It was like getting a new iPhone or something. No, thanks, Francis.
So thank you for being here. I want you to feel comfortable. Feel like it's your own home because we're going to do a little Japanese home cooking today.
Awesome.
But before we start, I do want to ask you, Ivan, so I know you lived in Japan for a long time. Obviously, you're a chef. You cook Japanese food. But how did you learn to cook Japanese food like at home? How did you learn Japanese home cooking?
Well, you know, it's funny because I never thought when I became a cook that I would also cook Japanese food. It was so daunting to get into a Japanese restaurant and be allowed to cook. Sure. And so very early on, I just went in a different direction. But I ended up, you know, even putting the ramen shop experience aside, you know, I married a woman from Japan and we lived in America and she missed a lot of things. And then we moved back together to Tokyo and there were all these dishes that she wanted to eat. And she just started, you know, kind of tutoring me on what she liked. And I started cooking more and more of these dishes together. Sometimes she would tell me what to do. Other times I would wing it. And I started gathering this whole, you know, booklet in my brain of Japanese recipes.
Yeah. Okay, so there is this idea, right, that Japanese cuisine, Japanese chefs are super intense about perfection, mastery of the thing they're doing. And, you know, you have a ramen shop, your ramen recipe famously is a 40-page recipe for a bowl of ramen. Do you approach home cooking the same way, a different way?
Opposite. I'm so, and that really comes down to the whole reason Chris and I decided on this type of book. There were many things we could have written about, and Chris is an amazing writer. We talked about lots of ideas. But, you know, at the end of the day, Chris and I both have families. He has a young daughter. I have three boys, and we have to get food on the table. And so, honestly, I mean, I put hacks in there, like throwing the veggies in the microwave, because I do that, because I don't have any time. I don't have time to wait until the carrots cook through. So I throw it in the microwave, you know? I mean, there are other times you want to, and it's legit,
yeah.
Because it's better than opening a box.
Right. All right.
Really,
and
is.
Speaking of your Japanese home cooking repertoire, and for your family, do you feel like there are dishes that just scream comfort food to you?
Yeah, and you know, I mean, I grew up in a family of a mom who wasn't interested in food or cooking, and so I have no memories of that cozy comfort food. And it's not meatloaf. It's not any of those dishes. It's omurice, you know, the omelet with the rice in the middle. It's curry rice. Made with, you know, cubes from the box you buy in the store. You know, it's ochazuke when I have a terrible cold, and you know, you pour a dashi or green tea over your rice with some, you know, salmon or seaweed or something, and it's just so comforting and pleasant.
Yeah. And you mentioned, Ivan, you know, working on this book with Chris. Chris, thank you for being here as well.
Yeah, I'm here as well. the book, on the cover of the book, it says, by Ivan Orkin and Chris Ying as well.
Thank you for standing quietly in the corner while I talk to your good friend Ivan.
Oh my.
But you mentioned to me, so you've worked on a number of great cookbooks with terrific chefs. And earlier when we were talking, you said, oh, this is by far the most cookable book I've ever done. And that seemed important to you.
It was very important to me. I think there was a time in my career, and I've done a lot of work in books and magazines with fancy, famous chefs that I really, really admire. And for a long time, it was important to me that we show cool new ideas from chefs that did things that were completely inaccessible to home cook. And I don't know if it started when I had my own kid or you know, when I just got a little bit older, but I realized that, like, thumbing my nose at making dishes that were accessible and easy and possible for home cooks and would help them make delicious meals for their family was dumb. Like, to not see the importance and nobility in doing that was a silly thing, and that's why we did this cookbook, because it's the first cookbook I've ever made that I actually pull off the shelf and cook from, like, every night.
Yeah.
And it's like what your earlier thing about, you know, like Japanese food has this reputation for being so proper and precious and delicate. And, you know, like the sun has to be rising as you are first slicing the tomato or whatever. Like it's really important to Ivan and I to dispel a lot of that. Japanese families are just like American families. Like you come home from work and you got to feed the kids and you got to do it quickly. That's why you use the box curry, also because the box curry is delicious. But, you know, these are not, you know, this isn't like American hacks on Japanese cooking. Like right. This is how Ivan cooked and ate in Japan and learned from Japanese families. And like this is that was important to us.
Yeah. Hey, Ivan, surprise, you have four sons.
Yes.
I'm your oldest kid.
Oh, okay. I was like, wait, I have three.
And now you're making me dinner.
Oh, my God.
What are we making?
Oh, well, we're making yaki udon, which is a super fun, you know, everybody loves fried noodles. It's really easy. You know, we have, you know, cabbage and carrots and peppers and scallions and, you know, mushrooms. But it could be, it doesn't, you know, I think of all of these things as clean out your veg drawer.
Okay.
Got a big veg drawer, just clear it out and get it in that thing. And now your kids don't realize it, but they're actually eating vegetables, but it's all covered up in this sweet sauce.
Yeah.
And so they think that they're...
And with some nice chewy noodles.
Yeah,
and
And
they, in this so case, some pork belly.
Pork belly and frozen udon, which is, you know, in everybody's, every sort of, any Asian market has it in their freezer.
Yeah. This is not like an artisanal product. This is like...
No, it's the opposite. Yeah. Which is cool. I mean, the whole, this whole artisanal stuff, it's just, I'm not going to say it's bullshit because I've based my whole career
also
on it.
Because it's public radio. No. But, you know, other
That's
reasons.
Fine.
It's other reasons not to. Yeah. Well,
yeah. But
philosophical reasons.
I think that the artisanal thing has its place.
But you can make this dish of microwaved stir-fried vegetables and noodles with beautiful organic stuff that you grew in your garden. Like,
absolutely,
that's the whole thing. Like, do whatever you want, but like, don't feel judged if you buy some commodity groceries, because like, we all got to put food on the table.
Yeah.
All right, let's do it.
Let's defrost some of these noodles real quick.
Put it in a bowl of water.
Yeah. One more bowl, Francis.
All right.
So I'm going to look at your cutting board right now, just for the listeners. There is a nice plate of like just big, super rough cut cabbage, some shredded carrots, some red bell pepper cut into matchsticks, a little bit of mushrooms, a couple scallions, a few slices of pork belly, about half a pound of pork belly, a very generous tablespoon of garlic.
You never know how many cloves are going to turn into a tablespoon, but that's closer to 3 cups than just to 1 tablespoon, but whatever.
It's going to be delicious.
It's all right.
And the sauce is soy sauce, mirin, sake, and oyster sauce stirred together.
Yep.
Let's do it.
Awesome.
All right, so
microwave
step one.
That guy.
Step one in this very chefy recipe.
I'm going to pull out a bowl to take the...
Step one is you microwave some vegetables.
Yes.
Where's the bowl? Because cabbage and carrots take forever to cook. What are you looking for?
A bowl.
Okay.
For what?
Taking the cook...
Oh,
stuff out.
Here's the other thing.
Oh, all right. Yes, I live in a giant suburban house.
Minimize the amount of like dishes is the number one.
Oh, I will tell you that I wash my own dishes. Nobody washes my dishes, okay? Except the boys. The boys do cook, wash the dishes after dinner.
They should.
Your kid cook washing. My kids, when they come, they'll be, no, when I was 7, Dad was making me wash the dishes already.
And I made the dinner for you.
Yeah,
so how about that?
We're just gonna, while the pan's heating up, we're gonna microwave the cabbage and carrots for a couple minutes because they take way too long to cook, and you'll save by microwaving for 2 minutes, you'll save 15, and like that's the whole game. I mean, you also like it took us what 8 minutes to prep all of these vegetables and pork and everything. It's seriously just all time savings and having to minimize the number of dishes you wash.
Right on. So you've got a big pan over high heat.
Yep.
In goes your pork belly. Listen to that sizzle.
And we have to do this before we get smoked out of this room.
Sesame oil somewhere?
Yes.
Does Splendid Table listeners know about how well organized and neatly set up your kitchen is?
Can you tell them?
It's remarkable. This guy has a kitchen.
Do the three letters OCD come into play?
With military precision in here, man. It's incredible.
I'm glad you didn't see the pile of laundry that's on my bed right now as you walked into the apartment.
What I did see was when we asked you for oyster sauce, you brought some crazy imported beautiful brand from Hong Kong.
He sneaked it in his pants.
I'm just saying, Francis Lam lives the life that one would hope the host of the Splendid Table lived. He is the embodiment of the Splendid Table.
There it is. Nice.
I'm glad you said that. And
come on, man.
I'm gonna go take the rest of the laundry down from the shower right now. Okay, so this is something that is probably worth mentioning. You're just very calmly cooking this pork belly in the pan. There's no oil in the pan. There's no salt. There's no seasoning.
Awful lot of fat on that pork belly.
Yeah.
Hopefully
yeah.
Render out some of that fat from the pork and then cook the garlic in it.
Yep.
Get as much of that pork fat onto everything as possible. It's like a little behind your ear.
And then when people, because when a home cook thinks about, well, I ate at this restaurant and it had so much flavor. Well, and it's right in the fat. So you render out some of that fat that's then going to flavor all the rest of the ingredients as you cook them. Those are all your restaurant techniques, coming up with extra flavor.
That's right. And that fat carries the flavor of garlic and carries the flavor of the other ingredients around with it too.
Yep.
So you're not trying to sear it. You're not really like...
No, you just want to render it, cook it through, get the fat out. And if you don't have... I mean, the other thing is, it's like pork belly can be slightly intimidating, I think, for people. The idea of cooking with pork belly. But bacon is more than suitable substitution. Yeah. You know, it's just thinly sliced pork belly that's got a little more salt, a little more smoke.
Yep.
But no, not trying to like really brown anything at this point.
In goes the garlic.
It'll make a garlic.
Nice. What do you think will cook? Take the longest to cook? I think these bell peppers.
Yeah, the bell peppers go next.
Oh, that's the sound that dinner's almost on the table.
That's right.
Get the kids in from the yard. The
sound of busy kitchens.
Somebody ring the dinner bell. We'll toss some scallions in here. We've got mushroom scallions.
Wow, that's starting to look legit.
Bell peppers. Man. All things that your kids will not eat if you tell them what they're eating, but if it's hidden in some noodles, they don't know any better.
I just want to take this moment to say with pride that my daughter will happily eat any of the things.
Once the vegetables are softened, we added the last bit of microwave vegetables that are really ready to go, and everything's, it's really, you know, I think Francis should come and take a look and look in the pot just to sort of give a, you know, confirmation of this.
You had to tell my...
His phone in the other room?
You had to tell my listeners I was busy texting while you were cooking over here.
If I had truly timed this perfectly, the microwave would have dinged at the moment I was ready to put the vegetables, put the cabbage and carrots into the pot, but I was off by a minute. So we'll do a little bit of sesame oil to get like a little char on the noodles.
Okay, so the vegetables are out of the pan.
Yep.
Still nice brown bits in the bottom of the pan. Up on it, clean it out.
Yep, then we'll try to scrape those up with the noodles, and then the sauce will take care of anything that's still on the bottom of the pan. But,
you know, frozen like, udon, man.
You get frozen.
You should always have just a whole bunch of packs of it. And then you like make a real quick dashi, you pour it over, you put an egg in it, you know.
It's delicious.
Oh my God, so good. We have a good udon recipe in there too. It's really delicious in broth.
It had really never occurred to me to buy frozen udon, but
I mean, obviously it's not as delicious as fine. You know, if you have a really good Japanese...
No, not because I'm snobby about it.
No, I'm saying it's different. It's not either or. It's really, you know, this kind of udon has a lot of really cool applications. You could also buy we also buy this udon that's like $6 for a pack, and it's really delicious, and it's very high-end udon, you know, imported from Japan, and we use that sometimes when we're like dipping it in really good dashi.
Yeah,
but you know, this doesn't need to be. This is just great, you know, frying
it
up.
Yeah, it's like having a nice box of pasta in the pantry. And
yeah,
totally.
Only frozen, and you can get it out of there in 3 minutes.
Yep.
So noodles get like a little tiny bit of a crust on them, maybe a little color, and then the vegetables go back in.
Beautiful.
Ivan, what you got there?
I got our sauce here. Sake, mirin, soy, oyster.
And that's it. Just in a bowl, stirred together, and now just dump it into the pan with the noodles and the vegetables. Now you're just giving it a little stir. You're basically just coating all the noodles and the vegetables in that sauce.
Yep. Trying to scrape all the bits off the bottom of the pan so Francis doesn't have to wash them later. What do you think, Ivan?
Looks pretty good.
All right, onto that plate.
Here comes Chef Chris.
Can you chopsticks?
Okay. It was just the closest thing to me. I'm sorry.
Splendid table listeners should know that Francis Lamb does not have chopsticks in
his
home.
They're right here. They're right here. Mom, Dad, do you hear me? Chopsticks are in my drawer. Right here. All right, here we go.
I'm not going to lie, it's a little salty. It's a gigantic nest of fat udon noodles with vegetables in it. And because we use nice oyster sauce and nice soy sauce, it's 15% saltier than it would be if I would use my crappy ingredients I have at home.
That was my fault.
No.
That tastes good.
Yeah.
But that was like pretty quick, right?
Super quick. We might not even have to cut this whole segment down. Chris, Ivan, thank you so much for coming and cooking your home-style yaki udon with us.
Awesome.
Thanks for having us in your house.
Ivan Orkin and Chris Ying are the authors of the Gaijin Cookbook, Japanese recipes from a chef, father, eater, and lifelong outsider. You can find the recipe for yaki udon at splendidtable.org. And if you happen to notice that Ivan mentioned omurice and curry as some of his favorite Japanese comfort foods, well, we've got those on deck. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. When you think of the great curry nations of Earth, you naturally think of Thailand, Malaysia, certainly India, even though there's actually no dish there called curry, but that's a different story. But do you think of Japan? Because it is just about their national comfort food, and it is delicious. It's complex spices in a sauce that's thick like Thanksgiving gravy. It's just awesome. Sonoko Sakai is a teacher of traditional Japanese cooking, and I learned from her years ago to make, you know, pure buckwheat soba noodles by hand. But it turns out her most popular class today is making homemade instant curry. Sonoko, so great to have you.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me, Francis.
So curry rice, you said, is, you know, forget sushi, forget ramen, right? Curry rice is really like the go-to comfort food in lots of Japanese homes, and that the average Japanese person eats it 1.5 times a week.
Yeah, and also when curry's on the school menu, we get really excited. It's filling, right? Because it's like carb on carbs, because you get, you know, rice with curry. And it's just so delicious. And curry originally started out as a Western kind of a high-collar food when Japan imported via the English people. And so it started out as something that people of the sort of the upper crust ate, and we call it haikara, high collar. But eventually it became more accessible to the mass in the late 50s, 60s.
Well, first of all, it's on its face, it sounds kind of funny, but it's sort of hilarious. Like, oh yeah, the Japanese, we got curry from the English. But it's like, oh yeah, no, of course, the English had their colonial project in India, and you know, curry had become popular there. When did it come to Japan through England?
Well, if you look at the history of Japan, Japan was closed off for 200 years. So we were just eating our grilled fish and keeping a very simple diet of miso soup and things like that. And then when they decided to finally, it's thanks to Commodore Perry, who told us, hey, open your ports, you know, allow us to come in and trade with you. So it was in the late 1800s when that started to happen, and the English came, the French came, and start bringing these new flavors and spices. So it's been about 150 years since curry has been around, but the first company that brought curry powder were the English, and it's a company called Cross and Blackwell. The Japanese call it CNB, and then the Japanese figured out how to make the powder using a variety of spices, and one of the major companies that make the curry spice is S&B. So it's not C&B anymore, but it's S&B became the national spice powder. It's a yellow and red can. And then companies like House Curry, that's another house brand, is another major food brand. So a lot of competition that started to happen in the 1960s. Because from being a high-collar food, it started to become a food that appealed to the mass. And they figured out how to appeal to the mass by using television, CM commercials, also doing storefront demonstrations, and just letting people taste this curry. The first cooking class I ever did in school was making curry.
And I home ec class so well. In like grade school?
Yeah, in my home ec class. And we just, you know, we already had the roux, the block, or I call it curry brick.
Can you tell us what a curry brick is?
So it looks like a chocolate bar, but it's basically a block that is made with probably like a dozen spices, and some will have honey, apple flavors, even pineapple, and some kind of oil, and also flour. And it turns into this block that looks like a chocolate bar, and mm-hmm. you break it, and you drop it into the broth, and you have instant curry. So it's like, you know, with instant ramen, you have this dry noodles, and you just have this little, the seasoning. It's like that. You just drop it into the hot water with some vegetables and meat, and it turns into this gravy-like sauce that you could pour on rice. So it was like a wonderful, quick meal for especially busy housewives and, you know, home cooks that needed to feed their family.
Yeah. So this is totally like post-war American food, right? Where like all of a sudden it was a convenience food, and that was what made this dish explode. Like you could make this delicious
explode. Yeah. You don't even have to be a cook. You break off the you know, the bar and drop it into the hot water and you have it. And you also have a rice cooker. That came out in the 50s. So if you have a rice cooker and you have that curry brick, you have a really nice comforting meal. And the curry companies were so clever. They came up with a variety of flavors, you know, Java curry. That was like the more hot and spicy version for the adults. Mm-hmm. And then they also aimed at the romantic couple, and they would do commercials that were, you know, trying to create a romantic dinner for his or her loved one. Or, you know, then there was the House Vermont curry. I mean, Vermont curry, which had apples and honey in it. And they came up with a nursery rhyme that every Japanese child could sing, and including me, you know. And then they would hire these very talented singers, Japanese singers, who would sing along the Vermont curry song. And I don't think any child even knew where Vermont was. You know what I mean? What? Yeah. Why is Vermont
curry? And why there's a curry from there, but here you go. Yeah.
To this day, it's one of the most popular curries in Japan.
Yeah.
And I don't even know if you could buy that brick in Vermont. It would be funny if you could. Yeah.
Well, I probably have some in my home, because I have to admit I love the instant mixed curries, Japanese curries. But you also make your own curry brick. How do you do that?
Yeah, so I started looking at the back of the industrial curry bricks, and it's just so full of, you know, artificial ingredients, MSG mm-hmm. and palm oil, which really bothers me. And I make my own miso. I make pickles, and I just do almost everything from scratch. So I spent about 2 years tweaking and learning to work with whole spices and blending my own curry powder. And I realized making a roux is very simple. You just, you know, you use butter and some flour, and you melt it, and you toast the spices, you grind it in a coffee grinder, you put it together, and you let it rest in the fridge, and it becomes a brick.
It's that simple?
Yes, it's really that simple.
All right, I might ditch the box then.
Yeah, and it tastes really good, and I started teaching the class to my students, and they loved it. It just became my most popular class.
That's great. I can't wait to make some with you next time you're in town. Thank you so much, Sonico.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Sonico Sakai's latest book is called Japanese Home Cooking. You can find her recipe for Japanese curry at splendidtable.org. One time, when I was a kid, I was flipping through channels on TV, and I stumbled upon a Japanese movie called Tampopo. Turns out it's sort of a classic, but, you know, I was a kid, it was the middle of the movie, I had no idea what was going on, but I couldn't stop watching it, because it was this scene where a vagabond sneaks into a restaurant kitchen to make fried rice with ketchup and topped it with an omelet, and it looked so good. And that dish, omu rice, is, well, it's kind of also a classic of Japanese home cooking. And to learn more about it, I visited Chef Shintaro Okuda of the wonderful restaurant Bar Moga in New York, who makes sort of a deluxe version of it.
All right, Chef Shintaro, thanks so much for having us here at Bar
Thank
Moga.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so omu rice. Uh-huh. The name is pretty self-explanatory, right? It means omelet rice. Mm-hmm. But can you describe what a great omurice is like?
A great omurice is like, so the egg has to be fluffy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not overcooked and it's super like yellow color.
Yeah.
And the rice is never like too sticky. You know, even though there's like a lot of ingredients that mix it up with the rice, it still maintained to be like, you know, like nice rice, like grainy texture. Yeah,
like individual and chewy.
And the sauce, like the sauce can be, you know, can be ketchup, can be a demi-glace sauce, can be white sauce, can be anything, but any sauce that's gonna be put on top of rice has to be like great, savory taste. I think that's what the great omurice is.
Yeah. So, do you know the history of this dish?
So, from what I know, this is something I heard, so like I don't know if it's true or not.
Yeah. But what the mythology of this dish?
Yeah. I mean, you know, like old Japanese cuisine has like a story, but like this is the one that's like, don't know where that comes from really.
Okay.
Kind of dish, but from what I heard, it's like there's one restaurant, it's like Rengate in Tokyo. It's like a pretty historical Yoshoku restaurant. Started the serving rice omelette, which is like the prototype of like omelette rice. And people were really liking it, and to the point where chefs are liking it. And you know, you can eat the omelette and rice at the same time with one spoon, so it's easier for them to eat as a staff meal.
Oh, okay.
So like they're, you know, keep inventing it, like make it better and better, and like start wrapping up rice with egg. And that's how the omurice actually happened, is what I know. Yeah.
And you mentioned this term yoshoku. Mm-hmm. Tell us what yoshoku means.
So yoshoku is literally translated to westernized Japanese food, like Western Japanese food.
Okay.
So it's like right after World War I, 1920s, around that era. Japanese people realized that after World War I ended, like we're too small, like literally size-wise, too small to fight across the nation with other countries. Okay. So trying to think of a way to make ourselves bigger as a human being. And we try to take what...
Like literally like to grow the size
to
of our
people. Be a bigger person, yeah. Like literally, size-wise. Yeah. So
do they know about genetics?
So, yeah. We start, you know, searching for, you know, like how Americans, how European people eating, like different things than Japanese people. So that's where we like, okay, let's start eating like more flour. Let's eat some bread, gluten. Like, let's try to take what Western people eating.
Okay, my jaw is like on the floor right now. Yeah. This is how Western food became popular in Japan.
It was. That's how they take the Western food in Japan. But obviously, you can't take it as it is, because we've been eating grain, fish, you know, pickled things, like literally traditional Japanese food a lot. And our stomach is not built for that yet. So we slowly like reinvent the dish itself to be accommodating Japanese like taste buds, like flavor, like easier for us to digest and stuff like that. And that's how the yoshoku stuff happened.
No kidding.
Yeah.
That's wild. I had no idea. It was literally because like, oh, we want to get bigger so we can fight Europeans.
Yeah, we're too small. We're too small for a fight.
All right, so let's get a little bigger here. So you are going to demonstrate for us how you do the omurice.
Yes. So what we're going to use is the rice. Barmoga's omurice is cooked with rice is cooked with the chicken stock.
Okay.
So it already has like base flavor of like the chicken. Very subtle, but just need to heat up the pan. Just going to scrape a little bit of butter.
So a little bit of butter in a nonstick pan.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're using, like you said, chicken stock rice, but at home people just use white rice.
Yeah.
Well cooked white rice.
Definitely, yeah. Make sure the butter's melt. Mash cook the rice.
Okay.
Make sure butter's like, you know, cover the rice. And try not to use utensils as much as possible. Just use a flip to separate rice.
So chefy.
Yeah, I like to do it this way because,
just, you know, tossing the rice?
Yeah, more you touch it with the chopsticks, like it gets like more like stickier.
Oh, okay.
And, yeah. You just like sprinkle some black pepper. And I'm gonna put in this the homemade chicken sauce. This chicken sauce is made with the onions, chicken, and three kinds of sauce. One with the regular ketchup, and one homemade ketchup, and one demi-glace sauce. Like a homemade demi-glace sauce.
Oh yeah, just lying around.
Okay.
Beautiful. Smells good. Smells real good.
Yeah.
And you have this little like football shaped or like almond or football shaped bowl that you're packing the rice into.
This is a almond rice shaper.
Yeah, okay.
It's literally what it calls in Japanese.
The omurice rice shaper, right on.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. And then you flip it out to a plate, right. And it creates this football shaped mound
this
of rice.
Is what it does, and it's ready to go.
Okay, right
on. To put the omelet on.
So now the technique for your omelet is what I'm obsessed with, because how you get it so runny inside but so fluffy is like sort of a miracle to me.
So the key is to cook it definitely on a high temperature.
Okay.
And use as less oil as possible.
Oh, really?
And cook it within 1 minute.
Okay.
That's a...
So high heat, a little bit of oil, fast. Uh-huh. This is like a 6-inch pan.
This is a 8 inches.
Okay, I'm terrible at this.
Sorry.
So this is like an 8-inch nonstick pan. Uh-huh. You have just like a ripping hot heat.
Right. Well, actually, it doesn't smoke though. It's like right before it starts smoking.
Okay. And obviously, a nonstick pan is much easier for this.
Nonstick pan is the must.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oil.
Okay, so just a little bit of oil. This is like a teaspoon of oil in your 8-inch pan. Yeah.
Just to make sure that egg doesn't stick to the pan itself.
Okay.
At any case.
Okay.
So this is good to go.
So oil's smoking hot.
Mm-hmm. And now this is the egg. I use an organic egg with milk and cream. So.
Now you just ladle that in, but how many eggs would that be?
That was 3.5 eggs.
Okay. So here we are back over the flame. You've got chopsticks.
Mm-hmm.
Stirring the eggs with the chopsticks, shaking the pan a little bit. Keep stirring, and when the eggs start to look almost like risotto, like almost like porridge, he takes it off the flame.
Take it off from the pan.
You roll the bottom of the omelet onto the top, so it's almost like a skin covering it.
Mm-hmm. And just tap it to flip it.
That's amazing.
Put the bottom part in again. And just seal it. Now this is gonna be put on rice.
Okay, so I need to talk about this technique where he rolls it right onto that little football of rice, and it is pretty. It seriously looks like a baby wrapped in a swaddle. Only you can't really see the baby, because that'd be weird. It looks like a sleeping bag.
Yeah.
It's like a really cute sleeping bag.
Okay, I'm just gonna cut it open.
And here comes a knife. Slices it right down the middle, and look at that go! And because it's so soft and so runny at the inside, the outside of the omelet just opens up and falls over the rice. It cascades over the rice. Oh, this is pretty. Okay, so this omelet on the rice is already beautiful. I've seen this served with just literally ketchup on top.
Yes.
But you have this beautiful brown sauce. Uh-huh. Tell me about it.
We're using a demi-glace sauce because we think it's more authentic, where like the demi-glace is like, you know, really Frenchy style sauce and this is our take of reinventing like the demi-glace sauce as a Japanese style.
Yeah.
Using a Japanese ingredient. So it takes 3 days to make. For the first 2 days, you solely use it for brewing veal stock.
Mm-hmm.
We brew veal stock very slowly so that, you know, all the good flavor doesn't go away with the high heat.
Yeah, yeah.
Make sure you simmer it for two full days. And then we add tomatoes, wines, and all that stuff in it to make the completed demi-glace sauce that takes another full day.
Yeah, to like it slowly reduce and all the flavors marry.
Uh-huh.
And you finish it with butter.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, because you can smell that butter. It just smells so good. It's crazy. It's like the most French smell.
Right.
Right, like so much veal stock, the aromatics, the tomato, the butter.
Right.
But we're in a Japanese restaurant, so it's a totally Japanese dish.
Yeah.
Let's do this. Let's taste it. Those eggs are so soft and so creamy and silky. It's almost like a custard inside the omelet.
Yeah.
And so when you're eating it with the rice is chewy and it has like a great flavor from the chicken and the little like crunchy bits of onion. But you keep having this like custardy egg with every bite. It's so awesome.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Chef.
Thank you.
Shintaro Okuda is the chef of Bar Moga in New York City. And you should really see his omu rice. I mean, if you can't get to the restaurant, go to your favorite internet machine, search for Bar Moga omu rice videos, and you will be amazed. And with that, we're going to say goodbye. That's our show for the week. I am going to go home, look at that video, and get to practicing omu rice making for myself. We'll see you next week. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media, and if you want more information on anything you heard here, there's always splendidtable.org. And if you don't already, check out our podcasts. They're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you like to get them. Our newest is by our friend Melissa Clark. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and it's all about getting great food on your table after work. This week, her friend Melanie Dunay stops by for a lesson in salads. Don't miss it. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media, and if you want more information on anything you heard here, there's always splendidtable.org. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.